Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.
Finally here, the Trump administration, after teasing it for months, maybe even years, depending on how you time it, has released its vision for Israel-Palestine peace. And it turns out it's not so much a peace plan as it is a give everything Israel it wants plan, and then hope that that leads to something that might be better. We'll get into whether there's actually any real aspirations for peacemaking in this plan and what it actually proposes. Today on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network, I'm Zach Beecham, here with Jen Williams and Alex Ward.
Hey.
Hi, team. We have a special guest today. That is Khaled El-Gindi. He is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute and one of America's top experts on Israel-Palestine-related things. He's like blanching when I say that, but welcome, Khaled. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
The plan, it's here. It's been called, depending on what you look at, from prosperity to peace. The deal of the century is a term that I think Trump came up with and everyone's making fun of. It also calls itself the vision inside the text. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about what it actually does. I've set this up to be pretty bad, right? So, Khaled, run down the sort of big picture rules of the game as laid out in the deal.
Yeah, so the plan lays out what it calls a vision for a two-state solution, in theory. At least that's how they're couching it. So the Palestinian state that they're describing basically would consist of about 70% of the West Bank in kind of fragmented areas that are linked together through a network of tunnels and bridges and various infrastructure, but not actually territorially contiguous. In addition to some swaps inside Israel in the south, as well as a little bit in the north. So that's the centerpiece of their plan, which is this Palestinian state that is essentially completely surrounded by Israel. So that's on territory. On security, Israel would have full control over everything between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, including the airspace, territorial waters, electromagnetic sphere, entry and exit points. The Palestinian, quote, state would not have the ability to enter into treaties with foreign countries. And of course, Israel has overriding security control over the entire blanket area. On Jerusalem, Jerusalem is exclusively Israel's capital. Palestinians would be allowed to have a capital near Jerusalem. They could call it Jerusalem if they so desired, but it would be outside. The plan is pretty clear that it would be outside of the security barrier or the wall, as Palestinians call it. And the plan is also explicit on the third major issue, final status issue, which is Palestinian refugees. And it states pretty clearly that no single Palestinian refugee would be allowed to return to their homes in Israel and instead would have the choice between going back to the Palestinian entity to be resettled where they are in neighboring Arab states or in third countries. And some sort of compensation package would be put together over the long term. All of this is contingent on, obviously, Palestinian acceptance, but more importantly, the Palestinian entity could not come into being until a whole array of conditions had been met, the disarming of Hamas, a long list of fiscal reforms, legal reforms that Palestinians have to enact certain kinds of legislation. And the decision as to when Palestinians met that threshold would be decided by Israel. So it's a theoretical, quote-unquote, state, and one that, frankly, isn't all that appealing to Palestinians in the first place. And as you said, I mean, it pretty much gives Israel everything that it wanted. And I should clarify, it's a wish list not just for Israel, but for Israel's right wing.
Specifically, right. Yeah. Right. It's an important distinction because when I'm talking about Israel here, I'm talking about the current government, which does not represent the views of arguably most of the Israeli public, depending on how you cut the polling, right? I'd say about half, roughly.
The latest polls are about half.
Yeah, but, you know, pretty remarkably, the plan has the support of Netanyahu's opposition, the Benny Gantz, the blue and white coalition, and even the president of Israel, who's largely in a ceremonial role, but still has influences and is seen as somewhat of a moderate. And so there is a kind of Israeli consensus in Israeli politics about this is a great plan and we should get on board. I think the only real dissent on this plan in Israel is coming from the joint list, which, of course, is predominantly made up of Palestinian citizens of Israel, and they're pretty much in the margins of Israeli politics. So, you know, I think it's reflective of just how far to the right Israeli politics has moved in recent decades. There is much less support for the plan here. We see Democrats especially being quite vocal in opposing it as a sham, as a farce. They're using that sort of language. Both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, for example, have criticized the plan. And we've seen a number of progressive members of Congress also come out against the plan. And I think that reflects a shift that's happening in American politics. But from the standpoint of the Palestinians, this plan does not offer, it takes all of the issues that they care about, capital in Jerusalem, the refugees, not even a symbolic number of refugees that would be allowed to return. And most importantly, sovereignty, self-determination, right, are all off the table. And so the vision that the Trump plan represents is something more akin, I think, to Bantustans than it is to anything that we might call a state.
And sorry, what's a Bantustan?
Well, the Bantustans were, in South Africa, these supposedly autonomous areas for black South Africans, and as a way of segregating them from the white South African minority, but still while claiming the black majority had autonomy or statehood or sovereignty. And so these were sort of isolated autonomous areas that were surrounded by South African control, very, very similar to the plan that was laid out by the Trump administration.
So this sounds like apartheid then.
Well, that's the critique of it, right, is that it will lead to a permanent apartheid situation formalized and permitted by the United States, right? I think the question of whether or not that is what the Trump people wanted or thought of it is sort of separate, and it's whether I do think that it's hard to describe the end vision of this plan as anything but that.
So I want to kind of step back just for a minute to kind of talk about how the Trump administration presented this, right? What the just to kind of give listeners a sense of, you know, how they are trying to sell this deal. You know, they essentially said, Jared Kushner, so that's the White House senior advisor and obviously Trump's son-in-law. He was basically the grand architect of this plan, along with a core group of negotiators. There weren't really negotiations, but a core group of advisors with him. But they're essentially, his approach was, look, we've had these previous agreements over and over again. We've had all these negotiations. None of them have ever actually led to, you know, complete final status negotiations because all of these previous plans left the nitty-gritty details to the end. They laid out this broad framework, like the Oslo process, and basically said, at the very end, then the two sides, the Israelis and the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank, will come together and you guys will work out the status of Jerusalem. You guys will work out, you know, land swaps in the West Bank and who, you know, which parts of the West Bank Israel could, you know, retains and which part, or I guess takes, keeps, and which parts, you know, will be a contiguous, theoretically Palestinian state. Anyway, so it was basically, we don't want to get into the details, but Kushner's approach was, look, that didn't work, so I'm going to go ahead and just decide the details for you guys. We're going to sit down, we're going to write down the details. We're going to have a very detailed proposal. And in that sense, he succeeded, right? It is, it does say, no, here are the lines that are going to divide, well, divide or not divide Jerusalem, as the case may be. Here are the actual pieces of land. You get, you know, Israel gets this 30% chunk of the West Bank. Meanwhile, in return, Palestinians, you get these two areas that are undeveloped land in the desert on the border with Sinai and the border with Egypt. And so that was basically the approach, right? Look, we're going to try this different method. We're going to actually, you know, put it out there and you guys can take it or leave it. The problem is, and we're going to get into that, is that in doing so, they have actually made U.S. policy, stated U.S. policy to be things that we hadn't stated before definitively that that would be something we would support as a final status. We always just said, no, we'll leave it up to you guys. And that has essentially given Netanyahu a green light.
So I think my favorite discussion of the deal from Jared, and there have been many sort of cringeworthy interviews. Alex actually did a good piece on this for Vox, is the time that he claimed that he read 25 books on the Israel-Palestine conflict
so
to prepare
good.
For this. So in my head, I've started calling this Jared's book report on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I think that, that sort of encapsulates the degree and care of thought that went into this. Because it's billed as a peace plan, right? But it was done in the way that Jen was describing without any consultation with one of the two sides that was supposed to sign on.
Right.
Right? Like this was done by the Trump administration in consultation with the Israelis with absolutely zero Palestinian buy-in whatsoever. Right? It isn't an attempt to say, okay, here's a mutually agreeable compromise. It's an attempt to dictate terms.
Right.
Right? And I think the best piece of commentary defending this deal, which I think encapsulates the real spirit of it in a way the Trump administration won't actually say, is this piece in the Washington Post by an Israeli news analyst named Ilan Levy. And the title of the piece is Israel won the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Any plan has to reflect that. And the core argument comes a little bit down. And I want to read a short paragraph because I think it really is sort of an honest encapsulation of what's happening. Throughout history, the victors have always dictated the ultimate terms of peace. Is that fair? Maybe. Is that how the world works in reality? Yes. Conflicts don't end when both sides agree that they are tired of fighting. They end when one side, the loser, recognizes it can't keep up the battle and decides to get what it can before things get worse. And there I think it is, right? I find this morally repugnant as an argument, right? Like it's basically a claim that any time that somebody is victimized by another side in international politics, they just have to give up, right? And there's no such thing as fairness. Yeah, it's the Melian dialogue for those IR nerds who are listening here, just applied to the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Right.
But for those of us who have been committed to a kind of just two-state solution for a while, and you know, I grew up in a Jewish Zionist left-wing household, that was like our mantra growing up. This is a slap in the face.
And so really quickly, I mean, the Trump administration had been pretty explicit leading up to the release that, look, Israel has the advantage and Palestine does not, and therefore it kind of has to accept some of these terms. It mirrors or if not, you know, lends credence to that. That's the argument, at least the thinking within the White House. I'm not an expert on this situation, but I am focused a lot on Trump's foreign policy sort of from a bigger stance. And I've talked to Jen about this. I kind of see this from the view of like it's yet another maximum pressure campaign by the Trump presidency.
Oh, I like that, but just on the Palestinians.
But
that's
on the Palestinians,
putting it.
Yeah. Like it's you know, again, this is kind of like giving Palestine an ultimatum, a really something that is that the hope is would scare them so much that they would come to the table. And look, it's one thing to do that against a nuclear power like North Korea. It's another thing to do it against Iran, which you know. supports terrorism and has a missile program and might someday want a nuclear weapon. And it's nothing to do it against Venezuela it's a more tenuous situation, but a leader that has completely decimated his country, and there's another opposition leader who has the respect of you know, tens of other countries. But to do it against Palestinians is morally repugnant. You know, there's just nothing. It's not like they're really going against a lot of aims. Of course, Hamas, yes, but this is not a design. This kind of design just doesn't really make sense for this situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. It's what is so alarming and striking about what you just described is, of course, the power dynamics.
Right.
Israel is a regional superpower. It is a nuclear power. It is the only nuclear power in the region. It has the most powerful military in the region by far. I think that no one would question that. And it has for a very long time. And the United States is committed to maintaining that, you know, in the wonky lingo, qualitative and quantitative edge that Israel has in terms of its security. And the Palestinians are a subject population. They are occupied. Their lives are controlled almost every aspect by not just the Israeli government, but by the Israeli army. And that huge power imbalance is reflected in this plan. And I think what makes it so egregious is that it's trying to institutionalize that imbalance and trying to get Palestinians to sign on to it. It's one thing to say, look, you lost, you're the weaker party, you have to make compromises. And it's another thing to try to couch that as somehow peace. Israel is already implementing this plan. And so from a Palestinian standpoint, it's the status quo with the promise of, you know, this astronomical and highly unrealistic $50 billion in aid in order to sweeten the pot.
And let's not forget the Dead Sea Resort,
right,
which I'm sure the Trump company would be very happy to staff and fund.
Right. And that's one reason why they rolled out the economic part before the political plan is this is the key incentive in their view, because politically it doesn't offer much. It really is an extension of the status quo with some cosmetic changes, I should add, with the potential promise of some cosmetic changes down the road if Palestinians behave. So there's not a lot of incentive there for Palestinians because it's not all that different from the status quo. And what it's asking Palestinians to do is to permanently surrender, not just militarily, but to permanently give up their most basic rights, and to agree to live as a subject population that is still controlled by Israel. They can call it a state, but a state is a word that has meaning. And if a state doesn't have real sovereignty, yes, it's true, lots of states have limits on it, on their sovereignty, but there are no states that have no sovereignty. It's one thing to have limitations. It's another thing to simply erase the idea of sovereignty and self-determination.
Yeah. Just to jump in really quickly, I want to make sure the listeners are clear. We kind of touched on it earlier when you said there was Israel would have the security blanket, but I want to make it clear what the actual plan says, just for people who understandably probably didn't read the 80-page long plan. It sounds like a real estate brochure. So it basically tells this future state of Palestine that, yeah, you can have your state, you can call it your state, you can have your capital outside of Jerusalem, but you can never, ever, in perpetuity, ever have a military that could ever threaten Israel, that could even defend yourself. They can have an internal police force for, you know, internal purposes and policing. But it also says that Israel can essentially rescind that at any time and take over control. Like, it literally spells out in detail. This isn't just us being hyperbolic. It literally spells out in detail that eventually you won't even have a state right away. Eventually, and, you know, Khaled, I think you put it perfectly, if you behave. We heard Jared Kushner say in one of his interviews he was doing after the plan came out, something to the effect of, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's close, the Palestinians can earn their independence and earn their dignity, which I think really put it in pretty stark terms for a lot of people, that the idea that humans would have to earn dignity, that they don't inherently have dignity, is probably one of the most offensive things I've ever heard from a government. And I've heard some pretty offensive things. And it really just showed, I think, the world and in particular Palestinians, just how much, you know, how little value the administration puts on their lives and on their value.
That's one thing that people noted throughout the text, actually, right. If you read it, is its discussion of the Palestinians is remarkably condescending, not just in Jared's interviews, but in the actual text of the plan, the way that it refers to them, especially in the refugee question. I found that section to be particularly condescending in the way that it's phrased.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And it's a sort of plan that you come up with when you don't see Palestinians as having any real legitimate history or narrative or even basic rights. And so there is an element of dehumanization that is sort of been so internalized that it's completely unconscious, frankly, in broader American political culture, but certainly on the far right, both in Israel and in the United States. And that's reflected in this plan. This is a plan that doesn't even recognize the notion of Palestinian agency or the value of Palestinian agency. Palestinians are, you know, and, you know, the interviews with Kushner are almost unbearable in that sense. The level of contempt that he expresses for Palestinians is really apparent. It's you know, like I said, it's reflected in all of the details of this plan.
So I want to take a quick break right now. And then when we come back after our lovely advertisements, we will talk about where Israelis and Palestinians go next after this plan.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, listeners. One thing that struck me when we were talking earlier is when you, Khaled, were talking about the sort of Israeli political divide on that. I was in Israel-Palestine November, roughly on a reporting trip for a feature that, look out for, it should be coming out before the Israeli elections in March. And I've been talking to some of my contacts on the Israeli side after this plan came out, who are especially the ones on the real hardcore anti-occupation left. That's a small dwindling number of Israelis, but they're still – some of them are there, right? And they're not just dismissing this as a plan that's unlikely to happen, right? They are scared, I think, is scared and frustrated and like a sort of ironic, resigned fury, depending on who you're talking to about it. And the reason why is that they see this as a green light for changing the parameters of what's acceptable inside Israeli politics. That in the past you needed to abide by the sort of general American set out terms of two states negotiated by the two sides. But now with a blueprint that so heavily favors Israel, they are concerned that there will be no one in Israeli politics who will be able to walk it back to say the Americans offered us this thing and now we can settle for less than that. And so while it is the case that there is still a representation of this kind of Zionist left view in Israeli politics. It's much, much, much smaller. It used to be dominant, and now it's small. And there are the Arab parties that obviously third largest bloc right now in Israel's Knesset and or parliament, and they reject the plan in its entirety. It seems that the mainstream, in the way that Khaled was talking about, has been shifted so far right that I don't know how we undo the damage that is done in terms of what Israelis believe they're entitled to by the mere act of offering this plan.
Right, and I think you saw that. I think it's really important when President Trump on Tuesday. It was Tuesday? I have no concept of time. When President Trump on Tuesday at the White House basically unveiled this plan, he was standing next to Benjamin Netanyahu, and Trump made, you know, a lot of broad statements and this big grand speech, and then Netanyahu spoke. And if you listen closely to what he said very clearly that essentially the United States has finally recognized that Israel has legal and historical claims to Judea and Samaria. Which is that Netanyahu, in reading this plan, in hearing the words the Trump administration was saying, interpreted that to be America has finally agreed that these settlements in parts of the West Bank and other parts of what is occupied Palestine are not only not illegal, they're legal, they're also, we have a historic claim to it, right? This is the kind of Israeli far right, you know, dream is to hear an American president say that. Now, Trump didn't actually say those words, but in the plan, by saying that in this agreement that Israel would annex this 30% of the West Bank, Benjamin Netanyahu came out and said, look, this is how we interpret it. And I think that was such a stark moment for me. It was like right then I saw, okay, that's it. Like they are going to annex this. They feel like they just got the green light. And sure enough, he said that his cabinet is going to vote on Sunday on annexation of that chunk of the West Bank.
But it's interesting because on the one hand, you're right. I mean, that's taken directly out of the plan that they are acknowledging that Israel has a legal and historical claim to all of this land. Right. And therefore, anything that they give up is a concession
right.
on their part and extraordinarily magnanimous, and Palestinians should be grateful. And so denying the flip side of that, of course, is denying that Palestinians have any legitimate historical or legal claim.
Exactly.
Not just that it's debatable or disputed, but it doesn't exist. And they are there by the sufferance of Israel and the enormous magnanimity and generosity of the Israeli state. So that comes out. But what I find remarkable about that is that these are the very same people who Jared Kushner is going around saying, we can't look at the past. You have to divorce yourself from the past. That's how you have to look at this plan. So on the one hand, he's saying Israel has a historical claim, but history doesn't matter. What he actually means is Palestinian history doesn't matter.
Right.
Only our view of Israel and the Zionist narrative and that history matters. And they're also saying that Israel has a legal claim, but at the same time are saying international law no longer matters. That's the fundamental contradiction, and what makes this plan such a farce is that whatever broad principles they lay out are so easily and they simply contradict themselves at every level. I just want to point out also it's important to remember, you know, we can criticize this plan all day and all night, and many of us do. But it's important to remember how we got here. The Trump plan did not emerge in a vacuum. And there's real continuity if we look at past administrations. And this was a major theme in my book in which, you know, I basically lay out the case for how previous administrations paved the path for Trump to do exactly what he did. Past administration said things like settlements are bad. But you know what, Israel, go ahead and build in these areas that you and I agree on. You can build in the settlements. You can build in Jerusalem. You can build for natural growth. You can build in the settlement blocks. So they carved out all these loopholes. They said 242, the resolution, UN Security Council Resolution 242 means Israel has to end its occupation. But you know what? You can take your time and you can define what that means on your own terms. And maybe you don't have to fully end your occupation or fully withdraw from territory as international law requires. So they made all of these compromises along the way and basically allowed Trump to say, look, that old approach didn't work. It didn't work not because the vision was wrong, but because of because previous administrations basically contradicted their own vision and undermined their own process. And so I think that's an important distinction to make is it's true that the previous administrations failed and the old approach failed. But what was problematic about it was that approach, that contradiction of ignoring the own rule book of their own peace process. But the vision itself was acceptable. The idea of a two-state solution, the idea that Palestinians would finally have an end to occupation and gain sovereignty and self-determination. But what Trump has done is sort of continued the same approach while doing away with even the pretense that there's a rule book at all.
Yeah, and we're going to link to your book in the show notes. And I wanted to note, we didn't tell listeners this earlier, but you actually previously in your life served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel. So 2004 to 2009. Okay. So
that's an interesting time.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you as we kind of wrap up, because you obviously have some insight into what the Palestinian leadership, at least at one time, was thinking, I'd love to hear your thoughts on where do the Palestinians go from here. You know, when we talk about the Palestinians, I mean both the Palestinian leadership of Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank, but also Hamas, the, you know, organization that rules with an iron fist, Gaza. So what do they do, you know, going forward? What are you, you know, expecting to see? What do you think is going to be their response? I mean, we've already seen their initial response. Abbas basically came out and said, you know, our land is not for sale. Palestinians are not for sale, and categorically rejected it. But more broadly going forward in terms of strategy, in terms of what do they do next?
Yeah, I mean, I think Abbas's leadership is trying to do a couple things in the short term. We should expect him to go to the United Nations and try to get a resolution condemning the plan and sort of reaffirming the international legal norms of the peace process and the Palestinian rights more generally. He'll try to get statements from Arab states. So he'll go to Egypt, he'll go to Saudi, and try to get them to come out strongly, maybe do something with the Arab League in the short term, and all the while trying to get other countries to recognize a Palestinian state. That's the thrust of the leadership's strategy right now, is to preempt all of this by getting West European countries in particular to recognize Palestinian statehood. Over the long term, that's where we have a problem, because there isn't a strategy or a vision that this Palestinian leadership, or really even the one in Gaza, has for both ending the occupation and bringing about Palestinian statehood. That has been the case for a very long time. It's just much more exposed now that we no longer have the pretense of a two-state solution or something called a peace process that they could— you know, in the past, they could hang their hat on that. Now that's not even there, and they're sort of flailing. I think the first order of business for Palestinians is going to have to be to close ranks and to fix their house. I think one of the conditions that has allowed a plan like this to go forward is the fact that you have a dysfunctional and divided Palestinian leadership. That's highly, highly problematic. It's a classic colonial paradigm of divide and rule. It's so very easy to play one party off the other, and Israel does it, I think, with great efficiency and effectiveness. So these Palestinian leaderships, both the PA in the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza, have allowed themselves to be played and have lost sight of the bigger picture. I think that's a real source of frustration for ordinary Palestinians, both inside Palestine and outside. So I think if the Palestinians want to confront this, they have to somehow revive their national politics, reform their institutions, and basically fix their house first. And then from there, they could go on and decide, well, maybe we just abandon the idea of two states and demand equal rights in one state. Or they decide to stick with a two-state solution and pursue some diplomatic plan. But none of that's possible in the current state of disarray that we see Palestinians in. And it's entirely possible that Palestinians, when they take to the streets against this plan, could very easily direct their anger toward the Palestinian leadership at the very same moment. And that's a real risk for the leadership.
I interviewed a couple experts, but one in particular, and we'll link to the show notes, about what Palestine would do next or Palestinians would do next. And the big conclusion I got is that actually this peace plan will end up strengthening Hamas, at least in the short term, because as Khaled rightly mentioned, you know, Abbas is weak. That whole the Palestinian Authority is weak. They a lot of them have pushed for diplomacy, but right now with the Trump administration basically taking a diplomatic solution off the table for the time being, well, those who advocate for a sort of violent response, Hamas and Gaza, might have the upper hand in the short term, because the PA's sort of main strategy at the moment is going to be to keep conditions kind of as they were before this peace plan came out and outweigh Trump, right? He has the election in November. If he loses, well, then you're going to have a Democrat who will be much more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. Well, like, yeah, I mean, more than Trump, I think
is hostile to the Palestinians.
Yes, I think that's better. Right. That's more accurate. That's fair. Yeah, less hostile. And so, like, that's going to be the plan going forward. But this is, I think that's a tension to look out for, is how the Palestinian Authority continues to try to go back to what it was before this week, while Hamas tries to gain some strength and outmaneuver the more diplomacy-focused leadership.
One thing I've always and it's a really good point. One thing that I've always kind of been frustrated by is, you know, from observing this conflict for a long time, is that, you know, every time that the Palestinian leadership tries to take some international outlet or take some diplomatic outlet, right, they go to the international bodies and say, hey, can we get recognition? They go to the UN and say, hey, can you, you know, do something about settlements? They go, you know, say, hey, we'll participate in this peace process and this peace process and this negotiation and that negotiation. And it seems like, you know, every time that it's the U.S., that will block that avenue, right? Say, no, I'm sorry, you can't go to the international community because you guys need to deal with this and, you know, the two of you. So, but don't bring the international community in. We're going to block these resolutions on settlements. And just to remind people, Obama did block the resolution on settlements until the very end of his administration when, for the first time, he decided to abstain. But it was like the last days of his administration, he decided to abstain, and that resolution condemning the settlements passed. But, you know, like Khaled mentioned, you know, even previous administrations, including Obama, did have these mixed messages when it came to settlements and Israel. And so the problem is that, you know, the more you cut off these legitimate, peaceful, diplomatic avenues, the fewer avenues are left besides violent resistance, right? The more you say, I'm sorry, you can't go to the international community. I'm sorry, you can't actually have these negotiations because we just sided with Israel and you can take this plan or leave it. What's left, right?
And you're also not allowed to engage in the most basic form of protest, something like a boycott,
right,
which
exactly.
is quintessentially American in terms of our civil rights movement, our history, the history of civil disobedience. Boycotts are an essential form of speech, whether you agree with it or not, or whether it's effective or not, is a different matter.
Right.
But it's absolutely true that diplomatic avenues have been closed off. All forms of nonviolent resistance are delegitimized. And so it really corners. I mean, of course, the aim is to force Palestinians under duress,
right,
as a lawyer would say, to negotiate on the terms dictated by the stronger side. And so, I mean, it's pretty clear that even if you were to get some sort of a quisling Palestinian leadership that would sign on the dotted line, that would be an unsustainable agreement,
right,
in any case. Palestinians would reject it. You know, we've seen these kinds of colonial projects in the past where they try to set up a new leadership that is more moderate, more malleable, and it doesn't work. So, you know, this is what you know. I'm happen to believe that the ball is now in the Palestinian court. It is up to them. It is not up to the Arab states. It's not up to the Europeans to save a two-state solution, if in fact that's what they want. It is up to them They have to sort of capitalize on their own agency and as I said, fix their own house first, and then they will be able, I think, to undertake any number of diplomatic or political courses. But it all starts with first kind of having a unitary and cohesive Palestinian political entity of some sort.
When we talk about agency, there's agency on both sides, right? Like the Israelis are not just a fixed object whose goal is solely to crush the life out of the Palestinians. And I don't want that to be the picture that our listeners have leaving. There are deep and profound political divisions inside Israel. Mm-hmm. And it's worth injecting another note of nuance here, because while it's true that the two major parties, blue and white, the center-right party, and Likud, the right-wing party in government, have both accepted the plan, blue and white has been very subtle in their messaging about it. They've pushed for a parliamentary vote on their plan, knowing it will fracture the Israeli right internally, because the hardcore settler right wants to reject this plan entirely because it recognizes the idea of a Palestinian state. They have suggested they want to push for annexation of Palestinian land, but only in conjunction with any kind of some kind of international consensus or agreement from other countries, which will not happen. The United States is not alone, or the United States is not enough, at least in the messaging and the way they've described it, which would indicate that they wouldn't actually do the annexation. I'm not trying to set them up as sort of morally pure or like peaceniks. They aren't. But the Israeli elections in March are really important, right, for the state of this plan. How a prime minister Netanyahu with an empowered right-wing government who finally wins re-election and is able to get rid of the ongoing legal case against himself would handle this peace plan is, I think, quite different from a government led by blue and white's Benny Gantz, especially if his coalition partners end up being some combination of the left-wing or center-left parties with tacit support from the outside, from the Arab parties, which is he's ruled out, but Israeli politics is weird. Lots of things could happen differently.
That's the understatement of the year.
I mean, I think the core difference would between the blue and white bloc on the one hand and Netanyahu's ruling coalition on the other is in terms of annexation. If Netanyahu wins, becomes prime minister, setting aside his court case, I think we're much more likely to see de jure formal annexation on some level, particularly in the areas, the 30% of the West Bank that the Trump administration has given them. If the blue and white coalition wins, I think that may become somewhat less likely, but still a possibility.
Yeah.
Certainly. It's a difference. Yehuda Shaul of the Breaking Silence was in town, and
I've seen him speak last week too,
a couple times. And his analysis of Israeli politics, I think, is very apt. And that is, there's basically two camps. There's the control camp, the one that wants to maintain indefinite control over Palestinians and the land, more or less in perpetuity. And then there are those who want to formally annex it. So there's a control camp and there's an annexation camp. And so that's basically where Israeli politics is. It's whether the occupation will continue as de facto, on a de facto basis and ultimately de facto apartheid, or whether it will be de jure apartheid. So I'm not sure from a Palestinian standpoint whether there would be there's a whole lot of difference there.
Although, I don't know. When I met with him, I met with him in Israel and also when he's here too. He also illustrated that there's a third camp. There's the peace camp, which is in
very, very
dire,
tiny
dire
and not
political
really
straits.
Represented in the Knesset.
No, there's a small number of them. It's very true. But it's also the case in Yehuda's view and the sort of more optimistic people on the Israeli left that control doesn't just mean permanent control over Palestinian land. It means security. It means control over Israeli
affairs. Well, of course, it's justified in the language of security.
Yeah.
But what it means on the ground is control over Palestinian lives.
Right. But that also could be depending on the correct forces, the international forces and balance of power and pressure put on Israel could militate in a direction of backing away from the de facto
international
apartheid that you're
pressure. Can, in fact, change Israel's behavior, and it is the only way to change Israel's behavior because Israel right now has no incentive either for a two-state solution or a one-state solution, both of which involve giving up a measure of power and privilege for the Israeli Jewish majority, and which is, frankly, not that appealing. And so why would they give up privilege and power unless they are compelled to by outside forces and have an incentive, or in some cases a disincentive, from continuing to maintain the status quo.
I would love to do a whole nother episode with Khaled about what this international pressure could look like and if there's any possible optimistic take on the world's most depressing political issue. But for now, I want to thank you very much, Khaled, for coming in and talking with us. I really, really appreciate you taking your time.
Thanks for having me.
Hope you have another book coming out, because the first one did great.
Not soon.
As always, I want to thank our engineer, Malachi Brodus, our producer, Jackson Bierfeld, and I want to encourage you to rate and subscribe and review Worldly wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.